Documentaries.
Uh-huh.
History. Insights. Interviews. Chef's Deep Dive.
And welcome to Shep's Deep Dive, and we've got our guest back. He's our fearless, intrepid reporter. He's the man in the know. It's Simon Goff.
How you doing, Simon?
Hi, Cliff. You all right?
How's your fearless, intrepid in reporting going on?
Well, yeah, no, absolutely. I was just thinking how intrepidly I needed to go and investigate my fridge in a bit and get a beer. So, yeah. Absolutely. I like that. Fearless and intrepid.
I tell you what, Simon Goff is on YouTube now, ladies and gentlemen. So if you're listening to this for the first time, go to Shep's Deep Dive on our YouTube. We've got With Neil and I on there. You see Simon's pretty face. He's on there. And he's doing quite well, actually. He's had 100 views, just over 100 views.
Well, I hope everybody's enjoyed it. And I sincerely hope that the YouTube stats don't show that people watch it for an average of 34 seconds and then
see your face and run off.
And I hope comments are turned off as well to avoid any unpleasantness.
I put the comments on myself.
Yeah.
Cliff, you're so really shit.
Who the fuck are you?
Oh, it's me.
No, it's good. I mean, it's on the internet now. It can never be taken down. It's out there for perpetuity. So, yeah, you know, but it's good. I love doing these. It's great to have a bit of a natter and talk some shit and maybe the odd tiny nugget of sense about
hopefully a bit of sense. Because Simon Goff is blessing us because we're doing a test today. This is going to be a first of many, we hope. But we're not looking at films today. We're looking at albums. This is the top five albums from the 70s picked by Simon Goff.
Well, Cliff, and absolutely jumped at the chance to do this.
You did actually. You came back on your social media faster than anything. Usually, I had to wait for a pigeon to come flying through the door.
I actually activated my mobile cellular telecommunication device and applied within about 48 hours. So, yeah, you should certainly
that is
feel
really more, good going. I felt quite blessed actually.
No, it was good. I mean, anybody who knows me knows that I love my music probably. If not, well, certainly as much as I love films and probably more. So, yeah, it was really, really good. I sat and had a proper think about which albums to pick. I was going to say as well, we'll need to run through the ones I have picked. I'll probably mention a few that were pretty close as well. And also, key crucial point here, this isn't actually my top five. This is just the five that I fancied at the time because I'll undoubtedly have forgotten at least a couple that I like more than these ones. Just one of them. I'm not one of these people that's got it like tattooed what their top three is or anything. So
yeah. Right. So Simon Goff, give us your first. And no particular order, or are they ranked in your head as an order?
No, not really. The first one that I thought of was this is an album that's the early part of the decade, 71 it came out. Absolute huge global record, this, from a massive band. This was the record that basically made them the biggest band in the world. Led Zeppelin 4 is the album.
Yes, Led Zeppelin 4.
I bought this on vinyl when I first got it. It's quite well known because it's a gatefold sleeve, and it's quite clever. There's a nice image on the front cover, and then when you open the unfold it, you can see that the nice image is actually the wall of a ruined house, and you can see all the rubble and all the kind of stuff in the background, and it's a house that's been demolished. But the way they did it, the view on the front cover's quite picturesque. So it's like it's a kind of, oh, there's more to this than meets the eye, sort of a metaphor. So amazing album there. So I got into it. I was going through a phase. I bought it when I was a teenager. And a friend of mine one of my best friends had basically said to me, oh, you ought to listen to these, they're amazing, was Led Zeppelin, right? I didn't really know who they were. I'd heard of them, but I didn't know what they did or anything. Except I'd heard of Whole Lot of Love, which is an amazing, amazing track. And I remember just not knowing really much about Led Zeppelin and just thinking, well, this is the best album, supposedly, so I'll go and buy it. And yeah, it's amazing.
It is a strange looking album as well, isn't it? You have to know what you're getting because it doesn't say it at all on the cover of the album.
No, absolutely. It is a bit mad. You know, with the gatefold sleeve as well. So you open it out and then you realise that the picture isn't actually quite what you think it is anyway.
When I first got this album, I've got the album as well, when I was back in London because I had a record player and I've still got my albums as well. I always thought that old geezer carrying that load of wood on his back represented the Headley Grange where they was recording it. I thought that must be that.
I don't know. I think they just tried to be a bit clever with it and that's what a lot of artists used to do then, you know, because don't forget, this was just as some of the prog artists were starting to really emerge and they were starting to go a bit berserk with all their record art and stuff, you know, Yes and people like this that, yeah. Early 70s was when, you know, partly because of how successful Led Zeppelin were, they were making so much money for the record companies that they were having an absolute fortune of marketing money thrown at them because it was when the marketing industry really started to take off.
Yeah.
And you were really trying to promote your band through all sorts of sort of measures that people nowadays would sort of think were ridiculous, like giving away stuff inside the record, you know, like the Beatles, you know, Sgt. Pepper's got the little cardboard cutout stuff.
That's
in it.
Right. And Pink Floyd, also on the Dark Side of the Moon, had little postcards and posters. I think most of their albums, you got stuff with it, wasn't it?
It was a bit more of an innocent age when it came to people collecting things and whatnot. So, but it's an incredible album. I mean, they'd been touring America for 2 or 3 years before they did this album. Well, no, 2 or 3 years, for probably 18 months before they did this album.
Wow.
And they'd produced 3 albums that are all complete classics in the space of the preceding couple of years. But they were very, very in the zone when they did this. But they were just also starting to really branch out a little bit. And it's got some quite key songs on it. Battle of Evermore, which is one of the other tracks, which I deeply love. Probably, you know, probably prefer that to Stairway, actually. But that's all just a mandolin and incredibly atmospheric record. Just amazing tune. And also When the Levee Breaks, which is incredible as well.
Yes.
But really starting to... They stayed in touch with where they'd come from, which was basically the blues. But then there's a couple of incredible riffs on it. And then obviously you got Stairway to Heaven, which established this kind of... It's all about Jimmy and the solo.
Right.
And you get to the point where 5 or 6 years later when they're doing concerts and he's literally using a violin bow to play the guitar, you know, behind his back or something. And his solos were like these sort of 10-minute, 15-minute events. And, you know, it's ridiculous. But
that's always been one of my reasons of why I like going to a concert, and if they do something more than just the album. How many times have you been to a concert and they've played the album as the album? It's when they come on and they add in that extra long solos, add in the extra long riffs, like you said as well, which makes you think, well, this was worth me paying 80 quid to come to the bloody show, wasn't it? And do you reckon, what was the reason you picked this out of all the other Led Zeppelin? Because this is also the first time they went to Headley Grange, wasn't it?
Yeah, well, to be honest, Led Zepp 2 is from the wrong decade, so I couldn't pick that.
Yeah.
So that came out in 69. I think subsequent records to this, I mean, this was the last one of the series which were just known as the Led Zeppelin numbers because they didn't actually give them titles.
Yeah.
But the one they did after this was Physical Graffiti, I think, which is the one with Kashmir on it, which was a double album. And it's good, but I listened to this when I was 15, and yeah. It's been with me ever since. And so I just know it like that. It's like an old friend. So if you were going to pick an album, I would probably go for Led Zeppelin 2 across all of their albums. But it's, you know, it's not from the 70s. Yeah. So I thought, well, I'll pick this because it is awesome. It's awesome, this album. But a lot of their later stuff is a bit blousy for me. I never really got into it quite as much.
Yeah. Well, this one does have, for me, some of the best tracks. I listened to it the other day, knowing that you said you was picking this one. And yeah. I just went through it, and then I read bits about it, and just how well it's done and how well it still stays up into the top 100 albums ever in so many different charts throughout the world. So this, Led Zeppelin number 4, really good album. What's your next one?
Well, this is probably something that I got to a bit later. So this was when I got into this record when I lived in Sheffield. So we're probably talking about 15 years ago, something like that. But a band that basically ran throughout the 70s, incredible, quite grown up, but Steely Dan. And this is the album's yes. Ager.
You recommended it to me once. And I was listening to Spotify, and I put it on, and I haven't looked back, because I was like, I haven't not heard this before, because you know what I mean? It's very jazzy, very progressive. I just thought this is new to me. I felt a bit dumb at the time for not having to heard it before as well.
Well, it was only a few years prior to that I was in exactly the same boat of like, fucking hell, how the hell have I missed this? There's one song on it that is got a sample taken out of it that was absolutely huge when I was a bit younger. Well, when we were younger, which was a sample by Dead Soul from a song called I Know. And they took the chorus out of Peg, which is on this album. The other thing about it, I mean, so I got put onto it by somebody I used to work with, I think.
It's for a lot, the length of the album as well. This is what I was taken aback. It's quite a small length of album. It's like 40 minutes long.
Yeah. It took them long enough to record it.
There's a big distance between this and the last one they did.
Yeah, I mean, I think they spent a good 18 months or so recording it and especially mixing it, I think. No, there's actually a really good... if you've ever seen that series, Classic Albums, which is like a VH1 series.
I used to love it.
Yeah. There's an absolutely brilliant episode about Ager, because the two guys that were like the main guys in Steely Dan are just sat at the mixing desk playing all the master tapes and just chatting about when they were recording. But what they were notorious for, and this album was when they really first went berserk on it, was... When they started in New York, the New Yorkers, and it was local guys in New York that put the band together, and they used to gig, and they were a normal band, right? So it was five of them, I think. Two guitarists, you know, bass, keyboards, and drums. Keyboards and one of the guitarists did the vocals. And then, I think that's right. Anyway, they were arseholes to some extent. The two main guys, they were like quite hard to work with. The band basically split a bit and they kept replacing them with new members. And then eventually they just got fed up with touring. and they just decided to be a studio band. And back then, you could afford to do that if you'd sold enough records. Nowadays, you wouldn't be able to afford it because nobody buys your records. So you've got to make your money on tour.
Constantly be on tour, haven't they? Yeah.
So if you're not playing live now, you don't make any money in music. But back then, they'd sold enough records that the record company was going to keep spooning them the money to keep recording. But the classic albums kind of touches on it. They would write a song and then they would get a load of guys in. They'd moved to LA by now as well. That was the other thing. So they moved over to Los Angeles, set themselves up over there. And they would just get session players to come in and do a song, right? So they'd have a particular drummer, they'd have a bass player, they'd have two or three guitarists. They'd play stuff as well. They would spend a few days recording the song. And the thing with Steely Dan was that by the time they made this record, they were literally they were sat in the studio, and the two guys, Walter Becker and Donald Fagen, were literally just having the best musicians in LA come in, play for them. This album's got like real heavy duty jazz people on it. It's got the best session guys in the LA rock scene. It's got some amazing players on it.
I know it's got like over 40 odd people on it. I remember watching the VH1 the classic album on it. But how does that appear to the person who comes in way Monday? Say me, you go in, play for them Monday, and they go, "Yeah, ranks, we'll get in touch." Tuesday, some other lads come in, they play the tune better than what we thought. Right, they're the ones that come on the album. You know what I mean? It's a little bit like manufactured.
Well, I think the impression I get from a lot of the players, because there's a fair few of the musicians are interviewed on that program, and what they tend to say is, well, yeah, I mean, it was a bit of a weird one because you were used to getting booked. You'd go in, and if they'd chosen you to play, then you kind of knew you'd be on their record. As in, you know, another artist. But I think a lot of them felt that because they really respected the two guys, I think they were aware that they were good songs, and they were real craftsmen when it came to arrangements, and they were also using some of the most up-to-date cutting-edge studio kit at the time as well, because the studio was like one of the best.
The production value on it is phenomenal. But I also have to think when I listened to it again the other day, is they had enough time to do it. Can you imagine that nowadays? If you're in a group or a band now, you have to do your tour, and you more or less say, right, you need one pumped out now. I want to spend 18 months just doing one album. It doesn't really happen, does it?
Well, also, I think a lot of the technology now is such that they're not actually playing a lot of instruments a lot of the time. And, you know, you don't need a drummer to put your drum tracks down anymore. The bit on the documentary about Peg and the song Peg, where they interview the drummer. The drummer is a guy called Rick Marotta. And it's a brilliant little sequence because he sort of says, well, I'm still quite pleased my take got on the record because a couple of other very good drummers played it as well. And it shows him playing the drums now, or when they made the thing. And he sort of says, you know, I was a fucking good drummer, basically, is what he's saying. I was a shit hot drummer. And I was at the top of my game, and I was pleased that they used my cut of it. But you just don't need a drummer anymore. So you wouldn't need to sit and have three or four drummers play that and work out which one was the best and get the best feel. It's all done off drum machines, isn't it? So you know, it's a different time now. You know, people can program the drums. I think sometimes they start with the drums, get a beat in, and then go, right, that'll do. And then they put their vocals and whatnot over the top of it. I think with Steely Dan back in the day, it was like, well, we'll have the drummer and the bass player play it together. The feel will be good. We're confident that the studio's set up. The engineering is excellent. The recording will be good. we'll use that take. And they might have done 30 or 40 takes of the backing track. And then they would start to overdub all the guitars on, and then they would do the vocals and yada, yada, yada. Yeah, and you're right, they had time.
They had so many people on it. You just read who was touching the production side, who the additional musicians was. It's a whole long list. Good job this album did well to pay him.
Well, absolutely. I think they burnt a shatload of money. If you read the... they did a load of reissues of their albums on CD, and they wrote these massively long, like, sleeve notes for all those reissues. And the album they did after this is called Gaucho.
Right.
It came out in 1980, so they spent even longer working on that, 3 years. And the sleeve notes for Gaucho's got quite a lot of stuff about the fact that they'd spent so much money doing Asia that they were getting a load of shit off their record company.
No wonder.
For how long it's taking them to do Gaucho. And it's funny, actually, because I really like Gaucho. It's an amazing album.
Yeah.
In some ways, I prefer it. But again, it wasn't from the 70s, so I couldn't pick it. But
you'll have to pick that for the 80s one.
Asia is probably, I mean, it's what's regarded as their best album, and it is regarded as an utter classic.
Yeah.
I mean, you've only got to look at the title track. Asia is incredible. Peg is amazing. That's one of their best known songs. There's a great, one of my favorite tunes on it is actually, I got the news, which is, the last but one.
Oh yeah.
That's got an amazing kind of bit as it plays out. Cause it's got Michael McDonald on it, who I've got a huge soft spot for Michael McDonald. And he was like in the Doobie Brothers. He was the main guy in the Doobie Brothers at the time that they made this album. But he'd been in different Steely Dan tracks before, and they got him in and did a load of backing vocals for Peg. But he also does the backing vocals for I Got the News, and a very underrated record. That is like the way it plays out at the end. There's like it changed the tempo of the song. It goes from being quite a mellow sort of thing to suddenly like the tempo steps up and it plays out on quite a nice high, you know. Quick beat, and it's brilliant.
Yeah, I noticed that one. That I Got the News. The change of a what you consider like a normal song of the beat, and then it changed again. You know, it reminded me of Money by Pink Floyd. You know, the way it halfway through it completely changes to a funky version.
Yeah. Absolutely,
and then it changes back again. Well, I like my favorite on that album is the Deacon Blues.
Yeah, and again, you know, Steely Dan, influential band. I mean, that's where the band Deacon Blue got its name from.
Exactly.
Yeah, great tune that, isn't it?
Yeah.
So mellow, so grown up, so sophisticated. Like, as you know, years ago when I worked for Robbins, wine merchants in the shop, I used to listen to this album. If I was like doing a bit of a shift where I was on my own, and you know, the shop would be quite quiet during the day, and you'd have the stereo on, and you know, that album, that track, that the album, to me, it's always going to be about a kind of phase in your life when you're sort of discovering sophistication, for want of a better word. There's a world of refinement out there.
Yeah.
To me, Steely Dan's all about, you know, it's an elevated level of sophistication.
Find this album compared to the last one, this one, a beautifully put together album from beginning to end. And you are wanting more, though. That's the only thing. My only drawback of this album is I'm like, I want more. I'll play it again. You know what I mean? I felt like I'm missing something. I wanted a bit more. I want a bit more now. Whether that's their intention, because there's not that many tracks on the album at all.
It's funny you should say that. Because we used to, the CD player we had in our shop used to have this, like, it was a cartridge thing. You put the CD in a cartridge, the cartridge in the CD player, and it would just play it back endlessly.
Yeah.
And so there was a few albums where I would just let it start again from the beginning.
Yeah.
And this was one of them.
Yeah.
And actually, when it opens up again with the beginning of Black Cat, because it starts with that bing bing, yeah, bing 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 bing, you know, and it sort of like hits this groove right at the beginning of that track and just rolls on that groove. Well, actually, that's a brilliant way to start the album.
Yeah.
And then by then you're like, hey, we're back again, and then you just have another half an hour of listening to it, and then it glides away and fades out, and then, you know,
back on it again, clunk,
and then back to that baseline and back to the groove again. So
it does work in that way. Maybe that was the intention for you to play it multiple times.
Well, we'll touch on it. We'll touch on it with one of the other ones that I've picked up.
So what's your next one anyway?
Well, this is a bit of a a sort of childhood classic as well. Similar sort of era for me as the Led Zepp. So not the most left field choice I could have picked. Rumours by Fleetwood Mac.
Yeah.
You're not going to win any prizes for originality by picking this album as a highlight of the 1970s.
But then again, there's a reason for it. You know what I mean? You know when something becomes like, when people are like, oh, that's so passé. That's like, oh yeah, that's just so 70s. But it was fucking phenomenal, and it still is now.
Well, I mean, I was just reading a few bits and pieces, you know, Wikipedia and the like, you know, just a tiny amount of preparation for this. And there's a couple of things that interested me. One was, there's a statement that it sold 10 million copies worldwide within a month of release.
Wow.
Right? And if that's true, because I'm actually a tiny bit dubious, that's a lot.
Yeah.
That's an awful lot, right? But if that was true, then, you know, a lot of people have heard this album. And I think it has ended up selling most of 50 million copies. And obviously, some of the tracks are completely ubiquitous, you know, and not only because, you know, it's Bill Clinton's campaign music and when he was elected president and all this sort of stuff, you know. But the other thing that I saw, which was interesting, it was quite funny and whatever, was a quote from some journos talking about the fact that even though it is an utter classic, actually, when you break it down, there's no real reason why it should be.
Yeah.
It's gone down in history and it's a classic, but why? Nobody really knows. Got that kind of intangible quality to it of why is it so amazing? but it was a complete phenomenon at the time.
Is it because maybe it just came out at the right time where people was wanting something like this? You know what I mean? You also got to think of what was out at the time. You had punk music, 1977. You had disco. You had prog rock. We had rock. 70s is such a jumble, massive market of new music coming in and out. And this music itself, when you listen to it, it sort of harpers back to another age. Do you not think? It's funk. It's there. It's rock. It's there. But it's like, no, it's more folk. It's more, I've heard this before. You know what I mean? It wasn't the progressive stuff what was coming out at the time.
I think they almost kind of forged something new out of all of those different influences they had, if I'm honest. I mean, when you look at it, when you look at the collection of songs and you look at the songwriters and the members of the band, actually. I don't know if there was anything that you could really pin it down to on it as a genre.
Yeah.
And I think some of what was so successful about it was just the fact that it was it had some variety and some diversity even amongst its own sort of songs. You know, if you think about some of the, you know, if you think about Led Zepp, I mean, Led Zepp was, you know, power,
yeah,
guitar, heavy drums, amazing singer, but it was a genre, like you say. Yeah. You know, a lot of the other stuff that was massive in the mid 70s was very genre, and a lot of the pop was very genre. You know, the Basic Olas and the Osmonds, and you know, ABBA had come through by then, and I think Fleetwood Mac had just hit this thing where some catchy tunes, some catchy choruses, some great harmonies, some interesting voices, an interesting male vocalist, an incredible female vocalist, another incredible female vocalist. You know, that's another thing to bear in mind. It's one of the reasons why I wanted to pick it, even though it's an obvious one. It's a very female album.
It's quite diverse compared to the others at the time that was coming out.
Yeah, and the women in the band led the music for me.
Yeah,
I look at the standout tracks, Dreams, Gold Dust Woman.
Yeah,
you know, You Make Loving Fun. I think the best tracks on the album are the women, and actually, Stevie Nicks is the exceptional talent out of all of them.
Yeah,
if you look at some of the other stuff she did for Fleetwood Mac. Some of the bits she's done since she went off the rails a bit, but some of her songs for Fleetwood Mac are their best songs. But equally, I think the Christine McVie stuff on the album as well. Songbird is the other one that everybody loves that Christine McVie did. And they were the leaders. They were the ones that were driving it. And I think people responded to that as well. If I'm honest, that's my take on that.
There's always the thing of it as well. I think a lot of the time when it comes up, when you're hearing it, like best album this, or they cover it on BBC 4 or VH1 Classics, is the fact of what was happening to the band at the time influenced the powerful writing within the music.
Well, yeah, I mean, they were famously at odds with each other. There's again, if you watch the classic albums thing for Rumours, they interview various band members all separately, because by the time they made that, I don't think they were all talking to each other anymore. And some of it was very, very raw. You know, Christine McVie had just left John McVie as they started to make the record.
But they contracted to do it, so she had to stay on.
Well, I mean, I think it was as much the fact that that was their life and their job. And, you know, neither one of them would have wanted to have backed down and left it. But she started seeing their lighting engineer. So she started a relationship with their lighting engineer. And her husband was in the band. So he didn't take it very well, it's fair to say.
No, I can imagine there'd be some riffs there.
So some of her songs on there are very... You know, there's a couple that are just her and the piano, and people definitely fed off that sense of personal drama that was in there as well, I suspect.
Yeah.
But I also think that because it sold a lot, it was very, very popular. So I think people then kind of had to accept that it was something because it was popular.
Yeah.
And if it hadn't sold as many records,
they could blame it on that then.
I reckon people would have found it easier to just dismiss it as, what, you know, nothing much, and then, you know, but they couldn't because it had sold millions of copies by then.
Yeah, you brought up a good point before that. You think it's more or less stands it on itself because of everything what was influenced around the time. This has got so many different songs, so you could probably have someone who loves his heavy metal picking this up just to listen to the Chain. You know what I mean? You could have a folk person who likes that and they could pick it up to listen to Old Daddy. You know what I mean? There's stuff in there where you think it transcends so many different genres. That's probably why it did so well.
I mean, the connection for me came, again, I, I was aware of this record from when I was quite young. You know, I'd just play it. I'd play it end to end 6-7 times in an evening, just while I was doing what I was doing. And then eventually, you know, because there was always a track that you wanted to hear again.
Yeah.
And again, the intro, the first track, Secondhand News, is so catchy. So I'd always want to listen to that again and then Dream straight after, which is probably my favourite song on it, on the whole album.
Or do you prefer Dreams as your favourite?
Yeah, Dreams is the classic tune from it for me.
Yeah. I like the Dreams, but my best on there is, well, I like The Chain because my kids love that and it's just the drums in it is awesome. But I like Songbird. I think it's just a sweet song. I like it.
Yeah, yeah. But I used to play it through and then Goldust Woman would be on, which is like towards the end of side two.
Yeah, yeah.
I think it's the last track. So Goldust Woman would play out. And it finishes in a very wistful kind of way, quite a mellow way. And then I'd hear the needle kind of go, you know, like you used to do on the and then it'd be like, one more time. And then I'd start it again, beginning of side one, Secondhand News. And nothing's gonna change. Yeah, amazing record.
So that's Fleetwood Mac, Rumours. Okay, and let's have your album number 3. Feels like Desert Island Disc, this, doesn't it? Oh, album number 4. I fucked that up. I only had to count to 5. This is why I'm an analyst. Anal.
I was going to say, mate, it's not like you crunch numbers for a fucking living or anything.
Got a calculator to do that.
So now, album number 3/4. My next album, this is probably the one that I would expect to get the most shit about from, you know, our active online listener and viewer community.
Yeah.
You know, when we do get to Comic-Con and we get our round table discussion that's moderated by Neil Patrick Harris or someone, this will be the one where I'm like, you know, having to fend off all of the shit. But it's a massive album for me anyway. Voulez-Vous by ABBA.
Ah, yes. You know what? So, when you first said it to me, I thought, is he taking the piss? But, because I really like ABBA. I admit, I love my disco as well. I love their, I went through and changed it at the time. So when you said Voulez-Vous, I thought, is he? Is he really? Right, I'm listening to it again. Brilliant. It's a brilliant album.
Yeah. It is amazing. This is the point, mate. You just said it yourself. So ABBA, you know, for anybody who wasn't around, so ABBA was some of the earliest music I ever heard because my parents were like many people in the 70s and they'd gone and bought some of their albums.
Yeah.
So my mum, you know, I was born in 74 and my mum was 25 when she had me. So, you know, my mum and dad, normal couple, still bought records because they were still quite young themselves, but they bought what was popular, big at the time, yeah, right? Yeah. So, you know, pop stuff. And ABBA were as big as it got in pop, but they didn't buy the first 2 or 3 albums by ABBA, which was like, you know, the stuff with Waterloo and SOS and Ring Ring, the things that they first broke through with. Obviously, Waterloo's the song that they won the Eurovision Song Contest famously and blah, blah, blah. But it got to a bit later in the 70s, and my mum must have liked this album. So they had Voulez-Vous, and then they bought Super Trooper, and then they bought Visitors, and then ABBA split up, and it was very sad. But Voulez-Vous was just in our house, and a lot of my early memories of being in the house when we were school holidays and whatnot. I'm talking about before I was 10. You know, I'm literally, you know, 70s into the 80s.
Yeah.
And I'm just sat there on the floor playing Lego while my mum's doing the ironing or whatever. Yeah. And this album would be on. And some of the songs, mate, I mean, because they did go disco.
They're two, you know, amazing musicians as well. You know, the workmanship, what goes behind each one of their albums. Yeah, they've written stuff to be commercially successful because they want to be successful. But it was also, you know what I mean, it wasn't just pumped out like a manufactured band. Like,
no, they were incredible. I mean, by the time they did this, they had basically taken complete control. Bjorn and Benny.
Yeah.
I always like saying Bjorn and Jenny, because I like the idea of them both having the J in. but saying Bjenny or Bjorn or Bjenny doesn't sound quite. But in my mind, it's Bjorn and Bjenny. Anyway, they had control, right? They built their own studio. They had their own publishing company. They had their own management and their own sort of business empire that had built up out of all the success they'd had. So the record label wasn't running them. They were running the record label.
Which I must add to everybody, like Simon said before, that was extremely rare in the 70s because you had groups more or less sign their life away, and some huge groups at the time just lost tons and tons of money. So these guys had their heads screwed on right from the get-go.
100%. They're famously focused on the money, the two guys. Like that's been a thing ever since they went on and did some of the other things they've done, because some people would say they've been pretty shameless about the stuff that they've allowed to happen since in respect of the legacy.
Yeah.
So, you know, compilations that they were more than happy to promote, and Mamma Mia, and, you know, as in the musical and all that shit. And then, you know, the fact that they got straight into doing Broadway and stuff like that.
Chess,
you know, famously. Yeah. But
why not?
I don't.
You know, when people say selling out, that's what they're fucking doing. It's their job.
Well, quite. And I don't begrudge them it for a moment. It's just that I think when you get to this record, I just find it so infectious and so good. And I like disco anyway.
Yeah, I love disco.
But they did get a lot of shit at the time, I believe, for the fact that people thought they were being a bit cynical by just drifting into this kind of, oh, let's just go with the flow on the style of music.
Yeah.
But I mean, they're such craftsmen that it's just completely irrelevant to me.
Yeah,
it's just immensely good tunes. I've got the track list up here, right? So, As Good as New, which is the opening song, another good punchy opener, and then it goes into Voulez-Vous, which is like just an overtly disco dance track.
That's a single track off it, wasn't it?
But utterly catchy chorus, you know, incredible hook. Funnily enough, actually, the singles off this album didn't do as well.
Right.
So if you look at their runner number ones.
Yeah. Waterloo.
And then they had, you know, Dancing Queen and Take a Chance on Me and Knowing Me, Knowing You, these sort of songs. About 76, 77, that basically dried up.
Yeah.
And they didn't actually have another number one until Winner Takes It All, which was off Super Trooper, which was another year or two after this.
Is that the second to the last album? Is it?
Yeah.
Because it was having a bit of a breakup within the time as well, wasn't it?
Well, I think two of them had already split up by then.
Yeah.
Anna Frieda and Benny, I believe, had already split up, but I think Agneta and Bjorn were still married, and then they split up as well.
Must be quite tried on them because, you know, there was all over the world. This wasn't just a hugely successful in Europe. There was massive in America. Australia loved them as well. One of my favourite tracks is I Have a Dream, which isn't disco. It's a completely different side. A soft and mellow tune.
Yeah, I mean, that's one of their real power ballad ones, isn't it? Like Chiquitita as well. One of the reasons, I mean, I never really liked that song.
I always call it Chiquitica. It makes me feel hungry.
Yeah, well, it's. I think it's definitely part of the whole the thing that people always said about them, about because they weren't native English speakers. They strayed into this territory sometimes where they didn't quite see how kitsch and how kind of cheesy some of their stuff actually was. So if you think about some of the, like Fernando as well. I mean, Fernando, you know, going off, we're coming away from this album. Fernando's incredible, right? Yeah. If you ever heard, remember the Brotherhood of Man that came out that were basically Shameless ABBA ripoff?
Yeah, yeah.
But they were called things like Ted and Barry and
Brenda.
Fucking Skinheads or something like that.
Yeah,
Thelma, you know. And let's get two Dolly Birds and two blokes, and we can give them the matching costumes and a bit of a dance
what
routine.
What was it? Save All Your Kisses for Me. That was it, wasn't it?
Exactly. Yeah. But they did a song called Angelo.
Yeah.
It just conjures up this idea of, you know, it's still quite exotic to go to Spain on holiday then for British people, right? Yeah. And, you know, or Greece, and just this kind of like Mediterranean atmosphere, and, you know, the dark haired, dashing, you know, romantic figure, Angelo, Fernando, you know, and just so cheesy. So I think Chiquitita for me, I Have a Dream, I think is an anthem.
Yeah, yeah.
Not my favourite because it's a bit too much like I'd Like to Teach the World to Sing. It's just a bit of a kind of...
Yeah.
You know, when there's a children's choir involved, it's like, all right, I'll tap out here. Chiquitita is just nonsense. Although it's a catchy song. You can't argue with it. It's a catchy
song.
It's
catchy. You can't help but say it.
Harpsichord thing at the end. The run of Angel Eyes, The King Has Lost His Crown.
Yeah.
Does Your Mother Know?
Does Your Mother Know is brilliant.
They're just incredible, incredibly good songs. And, yeah, mate. I mean, it's just a brilliant album. Again, I mean, I could have probably thrown in a couple of others. ABBA, the album's really good.
Yeah.
Arrival's really good as well. Arrival's probably the only serious competition from the 70s for me. And Arrival's the one that's got Dancing Queen, Knowing Me, Knowing You, Money, Money, Money.
Oh, it's got all the massive disco tunes on it.
Yeah, huge. But the side one, the first track, When I Kissed the Teacher, which is just like quite a weird song.
Wrong now, as well.
But again, like showing the times in some respects. Dum Dum Diddle is the name of track four on that album.
Yeah.
And it's all about a violinist, and the chorus goes, "Dum dum diddle, to be your fiddle, to be your fiddle tonight."
sounds like nursery rhymes.
Well, but with a slightly disturbing idea that you'd enjoy being fingered by that individual, you know, to be your fiddle. So yeah. You know, it was a different time, let's say.
I would put ABBA down as a supergroup. Yeah, I'm sure people would agree with that. They're a supergroup. They only did 8 albums.
Only. I mean,
but those I know it's saying only, but also you got to look at the time period. They did those 8 albums all within 8 years.
Phenomenal. Absolutely phenomenal. Love them. Love ABBA.
Turned you down, and they say.
and now we're on the last album. Your last one of the 70s.
This is one that is very much more recent in terms of the when I got into it and the impact. Incredible singer-songwriter, Bill Withers. The album is actually a live concert album, live at Carnegie Hall. Yeah, I mean, it's a little bit of a cheat because it is effectively a compilation by virtue of being a concert.
Yeah.
But Bill Withers. I mean, yeah, I think, to be fair, a lot of people have heard Lovely Day, which was a huge hit for him.
Yeah.
And there was a big remix of that that came out late 80s. Oh, of course, it was a big hit.
Yeah.
Which brought him back into the public consciousness a little bit. But then I also think the other thing that probably sparked it a little bit for me somehow was Blackstreet using Grandma's Hands for their hit.
Oh, yeah.
No Diggity. Which made you realise how groovy his stuff was. And then, I think Use Me came back around somehow. It might have been in a film or something. Because the other track that he was quite known for was Lean On Me, because that had been covered a few times.
Yeah, yeah.
So I knew Lean On Me and I knew Lovely Day. And actually, they're not particularly standout ones for me.
Ain't No Sunshine.
Although the performance of Lean On Me
vocally
on this album is phenomenal. His singing is spectacularly good. I Use Me. It's an incredible song. The album is just... The recording quality of it is exceptional. The clarity of the playing is unreal. I mean, 1973, live recording. It's like the band were just phenomenal then, because it's as tight as a drum, isn't it?
Yeah. And yeah.
So yeah, Use Me, but rolls for 8 minutes, so really, really get to like groove on that. Ain't No Sunshine, that's a great song. Grandma's Hands, that's a great song.
Just jump in there on the Use Me. There is eight and a half minutes. Now, if you bought that, the album version of that is a lot smaller than that. I love the way that he just carries it on. I mean, that to me is a live performance when they're giving you something more.
Yeah, yeah. As it goes through as well, he does some quite nice little chatty bits.
Yeah.
Introducing some of the songs. He was quite a funny bloke, I think. He does I Can't Write Left-Handed, which is just powerful. I mean, people said he was too smooth, and he wasn't black enough, and he didn't reflect black society well enough. He was an Uncle Tom kind of character in a way.
Yeah.
Right, let's be clear. I nearly picked What's Going On by Marvin Gaye, right? Because, well, I mean, to some extent, I probably should have done. It's unreal. The next five albums of the 70s we do, I'll definitely pick it, right? Oh, shit, I shouldn't have said that. also, where's Stevie Wonder, right?
Yeah.
So, great question. Yeah,
people could argue the toss for anything. It's five albums.
The point is, right, Stevie Wonder's gone down in history as somebody who represented his community. So is Marvin Gaye. Bill Withers never quite got that credibility.
Yeah.
But you listen to I Can't Write Left-Handed, which is about Vietnam and what a waste of life it was. Yeah. Grandma's Hands is about poor girls, you know, with no alternatives and the way society treated them. You know, Harlem and Cold Baloney is about the black condition in the city. I think there's quite a lot of stuff here that tells you that he wasn't just writing about bloody... you know, dappy, love songs.
Wasn't just writing to be popular. He was writing quite heartfelt. So the popular stuff of like you said, like Grandma's Hands, you can just, that's from the heart. That he's telling you about his own family. It's beautiful.
Yeah, and I think you go back to the medley at the end there, Harlem and Cold Baloney. If you, I tried really hard to try and find somewhere where these tracks were on a studio album.
Yeah.
Harlem you can find on a on a studio album, right. But I don't think there is a record of Cold Baloney. You know, to your point about you want to see some musicians play some music and you don't just want to rehash of the record.
Yeah.
You 100% get that with that play out at the end.
That's a huge, like, 13 minutes. Can you imagine being there? It'll be phenomenal.
It's spectacular. It's so groovy. But the crowning piece of the whole thing for me is World Keeps Going Around, track 5 on the CD, side 2, track 1, according to this listing from the vinyl. That song, the groove on that song is the best. It's the single best groove I know. It's unbelievable. When the bass line starts running on that.
Yeah, yeah.
And the way he sings it, oh my God.
But it's like what you said right at the beginning. When you're listening to it, it doesn't sound like 1973, does it? I've heard of some live stuff, even on popular people within the last 10, 20 years, which sound dog compared to this. Whoever recorded it must have had... It wasn't even digital then, was it? It's all analog.
No, I mean, to be fair, I think there was a long time when... A bit of Burnish Life going on in the background there, if you can pick that up on the mic.
Yeah,
yeah, fuck the police. So people used to record overdubs and mix them back in over the top of the live stuff. If they couldn't, you know, if the recording hadn't come out very well, they would basically tart it up in the studio.
Yeah.
So you don't know. I mean, that might be an outrageous thing to say about this. You just don't know. But my gut feeling with it is that they were an incredibly tight band of really, really top players.
Yeah.
And that track, like I said, World Keeps Going Around, it's got one other song that's even in the game for the groove,
yeah,
which is Love Hangover by Diana Ross.
Yeah, yeah.
But unfortunately, the rest of that album is a travesty, so it's not good enough on its own to make the whole album worth it. But fucking hell, Love Hangover is just deeply, deeply good. But this is as good as it gets for me as a groove. It's just unreal. So I kind of, when I first heard this album, I was just like, why isn't this like one of the most well-known albums there is?
Yeah.
It's unbelievably good. So that's why I picked it over bloody What's Going On and anything of Stevie Wonder, because...
You want more people to hear it?
Yeah, I just love it so much. And he passed away this year, didn't he?
Yeah,
so,
in March this year, yeah.
Very sad. Although I think he had quite a good... I think he had quite a good innings.
81 when he died.
Yeah. Interesting bloke as well. He wasn't immediately a musician. He worked a job in a factory.
Yeah.
Wrote songs in his spare time, played a bit in his spare time, and then decided to give it a go as a musician. But then fell out with various record companies. I think he went through a couple of labels before he ended up somewhere where he had a bit more creative freedom. But by then he'd almost lost interest, I think. And then he kind of just left the music industry and he never seemed to really come back. So
it comes across to me, or maybe someone would do a film of him. You never know, there's always pumping a film out. But he comes across to me quite strong-willed. He was able to, like, you know, this is what I want. I'm not having it, I'll just walk away.
Yeah, yeah.
But level-headed enough as well, you know what I mean? He did his own thing.
I also think, yeah, I think you're right. I also suspect that there was probably some unfortunate timing in that when he decided to walk away from it in the 80s,
yeah,
with the way that the music industry was then, nobody would have been worried about trying to bring him back.
Yeah, yeah.
But somebody of this quality who decides to step away from the music industry in, let's say, 2015,
yeah,
not 1985, do you think there's any way that they would have been allowed to just disappear and be a plumber or something?
No.
You know what I mean? Do you think they would have let him quietly retire? No, not in a million years. He'd have been looked after better in the first place.
Yeah.
But then obviously you've only got to look at the state of some of these people now, in terms of the Stones, the Who.
Yeah, that's true.
They need putting out to grass badly, don't they?
It's like, right? Come on, how many last tours are they doing?
Well, I just think people in those bands in their 70s, I just think it's embarrassing.
Yeah.
Going off topic a little bit here, but the Stones at Glastonbury is the worst thing I've ever seen on Glastonbury. It was a fucking joke.
I tell you what was good in Glastonbury, bringing back an old artist, which they did about 10 years ago, was when Neil Diamond played in Glastonbury. I like that.
Oh, yeah. No.
That was good.
Neil Diamond's done it. Dolly Parton's done it. Kenny Rogers has done it. Tom Jones has done it. I think that's superb, right? Yeah. But what's that? That's everybody knowing that it's a big sing-along.
Yeah.
It's a Sunday tea time.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
It's not that artist telling themselves that they're the headliners and that they're hot shit.
No, it's just... You're during the day singing. Yeah.
And they know where they are. They know what they're doing. They know that they're knocking out hits for people who are feeling nostalgic. The Stones seem to think that they're still somehow
up there
in the mix as a contemporary band. And you just sort of want to say to them, boys, seriously, pack it in. Go home. Right? Anyway.
So we've done your top five. Well, I shouldn't say top five because, like you said, as we was talking, other ones came to our brain.
Five of the best
of the 70s.
Five of the best.
With Simon.
Yeah.
And that's my first one with my mate Simon. We've done the top five. And he's going to come on again, I hope. We'll do a different one. We'll maybe do top five, I don't know, most happiest tunes, top five 50s rock and roll, top five anything, and hopefully we'll get Simon on again. So are you going to come on again, Simon?
Absolutely, mate. I mean, I think we could deep dive into some, maybe into some particular bands and talk about their whole career.
Yeah, that would be a cracking one to do. Yeah. Right, so let's finish off. So it's been great having Simon back again. And as always, we'll finish off with a song. So it's going to be hard to pick one out of the five. Or are you going to pick something completely different? It's up to you.
Well, okay. If you get to pick one thing from the 70s, then I do get to pick the song that I wanted to somehow mention, but I couldn't find a way to get the album in. So we'll go Love Hangover, Diana Ross.
Oh, beautiful tune. Beautiful tune. Lovely lady as well.
Listen to it all. Do not cut it, Cliff.
Do not cut it.
It's about 7 or 8 minutes, but it won't get cut.
It won't get cut. Well, on the pod audio, YouTube might get a bit funny. I have to be quite clever with the YouTube bit. Okay, and thank you very much, Simon. Thank you, everybody, for listening.
sleep.